Well, I'm very happy to be able to speak to you, not only because Mexico is for many years one of my absolutely favorite nations on this planet, but because we have right now an unprecedented moment in history. We are facing right now a breakdown crisis of the entire civilization. There is not one country, not one continent, which is not disintegrating at a breathtaking speed, so that we are really, you know, faced with a situation where the moral fiber of mankind is being tested. Will we be able to change our ways? Will we be able to break with a political order which does no longer guarantee the survival of billions of people on this planet? Well, first of all, this is not a financial crisis, a crisis which, you know, has a cyclical development and then eventually an upswing, a boom, and ends. But we are looking at a breakdown of the entire planet. And just from discussions over the recent days in several European countries, there is no question that more and more people recognize that. And they recognize it because they are either in agriculture, or they are mayors, or they are strategists, or they are, you know, they're looking at this process of collapse from their angle, and they contribute more and more details. And if you put the whole picture together, it is not a there is no question that the whole planet is right now disintegrating. I mean, the culture is just collapsing. There is no simple remedy for this. If you look around, there is not one government at this point which is prepared to address the dimension of the crisis or to put forward a solution which would be a remedy for the entire globe. This may sound, you know, a lot for you, but I think you have to start facing that reality, because otherwise you are not able to take adequate steps. What we are looking at is, in the first time in history, a real tragedy of civilization as a whole. In the past, you had cultures going under, like the Mayas, the Aztecs, the Persians, the Roman Empire, the Byzantine Empire, but you had cultural development in other parts of the globe, and, you know, people didn't even know about that parts of civilization were disintegrating. This time, there is not one corner of the planet, not in Europe, not in the United States, not in Latin America or Asia nor Africa, where there is not this terrible process of disintegration going on. Now, this coming Friday, you will have the fourth G20 meeting since the outbreak of the financial crisis end of July 2007. And this will not be like the previous three G20 meetings, which basically tried to paper over the situation by trying to pretend that everything was under control. This time, because the decision of the US government taken one day after the election to open the floodgates of money printing, there will be a complete turmoil, because the Federal Reserve of the United States not only decided to create an additional $600 billion to buy up basically bonds, toxic bonds, but we have from very well informed sources that the Federal Reserve decided to open a window for all the banks to take unlimited credit at 0% interest rate because of the complete chaos in the US mortgage market, because millions of forced foreclosures are now under litigation because the banks took these houses, but they didn't take into account that all of these mortgages were securitized many times over, and therefore the question of who is possessing these mortgages and who has the rights for this property is completely up in the air. So therefore, the Federal Reserve, in order to prevent an uncontrolled collapse of the banking system, has basically made credit available for anybody who wants it. Now, obviously, this means that you have a money printing, even if it's only electronically this time, but otherwise it's exactly what happened in Weimar Germany 1923. And this time, however, it is on a global scale and not limited to one country because of the role of the dollar, which is still a global currency, because of the fact that all the other central banks are doing likewise, like the Bank of Japan, the Bank of England, and the EZB. And the problem is that this money, which is now created, is not staying inside the United States. If it would go into investment in physical production, it would not be so bad. But this money is going into international speculation, into raw materials, into agricultural raw materials. And that is the most devastating part of the whole thing, because you can imagine that if agricultural raw materials, that is mice, wheat, and cereals, if they go up 40-50% in price for people who have only one meal a day, we are not talking about profit of some speculators, but we are talking about deaths of millions of people. So this is really going in a direction which cannot be tolerated. The other areas where this money is going to is the stock markets of the emerging countries. And with the debasement of the dollar, this drives the currency, the currencies and the markets of the emerging markets up. So the whole world situation right now, if you look at the stock market exchange rates, it's like as if they all would be on dope. They are all high, but it's like the highness of a fever. It's, you know, it's a very short-lived development. Now, all these emerging countries are completely afraid that one day the speculative funds will pull out. And they look at the memory of what happened during the Asia crisis in 1997, where all this liquidity was pumped into these countries. And then almost overnight, all these monies were pulled out. The currencies collapsed by 80%. And you had the huge Asia crisis, which again cost millions of people's life. Now, because of that, you have right now a worldwide backlash. And as of now, 2 days before the opening of this G20 meeting, the United States seems to be pretty isolated. For example, a Chinese rating agency just downgraded the US debt. Now, this is showdown, and it is completely unprecedented because, you know, for China, this is becoming an existential question, because if the US consumer market collapses and therefore the exports of China to the United States collapse, and at the same time, the value of the reserve, the currency reserves, which are in large part in dollar, collapse, this is threatening the economic stability of China in a very serious way. Now, you have a similar unprecedented development with the finance minister of Germany, Schäuble, commenting on Bernanke's decision to print money, calling it hopeless and clueless, saying pumping money will not solve anything and that he will bring it up at the G20. Now, the reason why Schäuble is saying that, and, you know, normally this present government would be very, very pro-American and pro-Atlanticist, but in Germany, we do have the experience of 1923. Every child has many stories from their family, from the grandparents, from the parents, of what it does if you have hyperinflation. Because hyperinflation is the most brutal assault on the income and the savings of the average person. Because in Germany, you know, people thought they had maybe 10,000 Reichsmark for their pension age. But then, you know, all of a sudden, when the inflation exploded in half a year, from the spring 1923 till November, you know, all of a sudden, one piece of bread was 10,000 Reichsmark, and all this money was out of the window. Now, therefore, because the experience in Germany is in the bones of everybody, I can foresee that this is going to cause quite a turmoil in Germany in the near term. But also the emerging countries, Brazil, Indonesia, Thailand, Turkey, they are all protesting. I think this G20 meeting will be a very interesting one. Now, we also face, together with this hyperinflationary explosion, the danger of a global fascism. Because up to now, all the governments of the United States, of the European Union, and many other countries around the world are reacting to this situation with massive austerity. And that was exactly what caused fascism in the 1930s, in the first Great Depression. This was what triggered Mussolini, Hitler, Franco, and the Pétain government. Now, for us, this does not come as a surprise, because on the 15th of August, 1971, my husband, Lyndon LaRouche, commented on the fact when Nixon lifted the old Bretton Woods system and the fixed exchange rate system and replaced it with floating exchange rates and created the euro-dollar market and the uncontrolled money creation in offshore markets. He said at that point that if you continue on this road, this will lead to a new depression and fascism or a new world economic order. Now, here is the raison d'être of the LaRouche movement and the Schiller Institute, because our entire international movement was built on that perspective and that analysis of Mr. LaRouche, saying, you know, that the system of monetarism would lead to a new depression and the danger of a new fascism. Now, on the 25th of July in 2007, Lyndon LaRouche made a webcast where he predicted he predicted that the world financial system was finished and all one would see were the different aspects coming to the surface. And 3 days later, the mortgage crisis erupted in the United States. Now, since that time, 40 months, that's a long time, have passed. And all which has happened in this period is that the private debt of speculators who misspeculated was transformed into public debt by one bailout package after the other, paid by the taxpayers of the different country. Now, as a result, you have many, actually dozens of countries right now who are insolvent, who are completely bankrupt. Now, the problem is that what we call globalization, which is actually a euphemism for the British Empire, if you understand by the British Empire, not Great Britain, but the system of the conglomerate of central banks, so-called independent central banks, investment banks, hedge funds, private equity funds, cartels, insurances, and reinsurances. And this system has actually created, in this 40 months of crisis, more billionaires and more millionaires who are on top of it richer than at the beginning of the crisis. You have on the other side billions of people who are threatened with starvations and deaths and inhuman poverty. Now, I find only one word for this, and that is satanic. And you don't have to take that as a religious definition, but if you understand under satanic, the deliberate destruction of every institution and every basis of human existence, well, then that is what is going on, is satanic. And then ask yourself, for what? For the privilege of a small crust of bankers, of top financial families who are using the swindle of ecology and man-made global warming to set up a world dictatorship to basically, you know, submit the world to a regime of CO2 emission trade, which is a complete swindle. It doesn't exist. And basically, you know, trying to reduce the world population with this policy from presently 7 billion to 2 billion people or less. And that is an immediate perspective, because if this hyperinflation explodes anymore, there will be billions of people who will be without food. Because contrary to the crisis in 2008, where you already had at similar agricultural prices as we have today, hunger riots in 40 countries, then there existed still reserves, food reserves, which do no longer exist to a variety of reasons, the big fires in Russia, misharvests, but mostly also speculation and also the equally satanic production of biofuel, which is consciously destroying agricultural goods, but also the offensive of such organizations as World Wildlife Fund, which takes more and more territories and prevents them from being cultivated for human existence, just to save some dried out old worm or insect. Now, if you look at the culture which goes along with globalization, if you can call it culture, you're looking at the satanic pop music. And, you know, I don't need to go into the whole list from gothic to various punk varieties. I mean, in my view, they are all essentially an assault on the creative faculties of the mind. Add to that the violent video games, the perversion of pornography. And then you see that, for example, in Germany, you have now 8-year-old children in school who are sending each other through their mobile telephones videos with hardcore pornos. Now, a child of that age has absolutely no resistance, and its mind will be hurt and maybe destroyed for the rest of his life when they are confronted with that. I can tell you the difference of my childhood, where I still had, you know, plenty of classical culture, plenty of creative playing. It was a completely different world. And I think we absolutely have to declare war on that culture, because, you know, I mean, if you don't do that, mankind will plunge into a bestial condition. It's already very far down the road. Now, we do have the program to solve this. My husband, Mr. LaRouche, has defined it and described it many, many times. It would be very easy. If you have a reasonable government in the United States, that would probably mean that, you know, that means for sure that with Obama, you know, this cannot happen, but there are tumultuous developments in the United States which can change that very, very quickly. Then you implement a Glass-Steagall separation of investment banking and commercial banking, exactly what Franklin D. Roosevelt did in the 1930s to bring the United States out of the Depression with Glass-Steagall, with a New Deal. And then in the tradition of the Tennessee Valley Authority infrastructure program, which was at that time implemented by Roosevelt, we will build NAVAPA and the Plino projects. If the United States makes a signal that that reconstruction is on the table, I know for a fact that immediately the Russian government will make an alliance with the United States to build the 100-kilometer tunnel between Alaska and Siberia. It could be very well that Putin will put the Bering Strait on the agenda on the G20 meeting, because they have said that before, that they would do that. And then if that would happen, if the Bering Tunnel is being built, you immediately could open up the far east of Russia, where you find all the raw materials and all the elements of the Mendeleev periodic system, the periodic table, However, naturally, they are under Arctic permafrost conditions, and therefore it creates new technological challenges to develop these raw materials. You have to have cities, covered cities with roofs. You have to have conditions for mankind, for people who are working there to live in a decent way. But this project would guarantee the raw material security, not only for Russia, but for most of the planet for the next 100 years. So it is one of the missions of mankind we absolutely have to undertake. That would immediately be integrated with the building of the Eurasian land bridge. That is the idea which we are pursuing since more than 20 years to connect the industrial and population centers of Europe with those of Asia, which includes wonderful water management projects such as refilling the Lake Aral through rivers from Siberia, which would be similar like in the Navapa Plino project, be redirected go south into the Aral Lake. It would immediately be connected to extending the Eurasian land bridge into Africa via Egypt, via a bridge from Sicily to Tunisia and through the Strait of Gibraltar. It would put immediately on the table the Transaqua project, which is the idea to take the superfluous waters of the Congo River area and bring them through a system of rivers and canals into Lake Chad, which has shrunk to 10% of its previous size, and it would enable, basically a complete development of the Sahel zone, greening the Sahel zone. So we have the plan. All these projects are ready. They are in the drawers of the engineers. And, well, what do we do? If the governments don't go for it, who should then do it? Well, we do not give up the fight. I say that under those circumstances, what is needed is a resistance movement, an international alliance for development, an international alliance for a new world economic order. Now, that can only happen if we change the present culture, which is condemning mankind to a tragedy. And what we have to do is we have to build movements in each country who reconnect to the best tradition and high phases in the cultural development of their country. Now, in Mexico, the last leader to stage a courageous fight for development was in 1982, López Portillo. And if you look at the attitude of large political strata in Mexico towards Portillo today, that tells you exactly what and who the problem is in Mexico. Because López Portillo was a fantastic leader with a great vision, who together with my husband, Lyndon LaRouche, developed this idea of Operation Juarez, which was a plan for the economic integration of all of Latin America. And if that would have been implemented, which López Portillo started to do at the end of his presidency, but because Argentina and Brazil at that time did not show solidarity, basically, you know, the project did not go through. But now I think people in Brazil and Argentina recognize that Mexico and them are sitting in the same boat. So we have to reconnect to Operation Juarez, to López Portillo in Mexico. In the United States, we have to reconnect to the tradition of Abraham Lincoln, the American Revolution, Franklin D. Roosevelt. And if America can do that, it can win back its soul. In France, it is very clear that the resistance has to be in the tradition of De Gaulle and the resistance against the National Socialist of the Nazi period and against the British Empire. The French have to uphold the slogan Perfide Albion, which was very, very known and encouraging at that time. And it is exactly the opposite of the effort to rebuild the Entente Cordiale between France and Great Britain, which is the present policy of Sarkozy and the British government. Now, in Germany, which is also being destroyed right now by an insane escalation against nuclear energy, against building of stations like Stuttgart. I mean, you have a complete madhouse in Germany right now. But I'm confident that we can revive the tradition of the great thinker and creator of the modern science, natural science of the 15th century, Nicolaus of Cus, who developed this very beautiful idea that there is a coherence between the laws of the macrocosm, namely the order of creation and the physical universe, and the microcosm, meaning the laws of the creative mind. Because if that cohesion would not exist, then people could not understand the universe, ideas could not develop the universe. And Nicolaus also had the beautiful idea that harmony, concordance in the macrocosm is only possible if you have the development of all microcosms, which means that peace and concordance on Earth you can only have if all nations develop and they regard the development of each other as their basic self-interest. Nicolaus of Cusa also said that, you know, we have to bring the political and economic order in cohesion with the order of creation. And I think that that is exactly what we have to do. The political and economic order has to be brought in cohesion with the actual laws of the universe. And what also motivated Nicolaus was a passionate love for mankind, a passionate love for the community of countries. So that was carried on by the tradition of Leibniz, who at the end of the 17th century said that he thought that if the moment would come that one day the entire world would be governed by utilitarianism, it would come to a world revolution. Now, I think we have reached that point. All institutions internationally are governed by utilitarianism, and therefore this cannot function, because that utilitarian policy is in direct confrontation with the interest of human civilization. And therefore, this order is going to detonate. And the question is, will it be a peaceful American-like revolution, or will it be a Jacobean revolution like the French Revolution, leading into chaos? But Leibniz also was convinced that we are in the best of all worlds. And that is one of my deepest convictions, that with Leibniz, I believe that every great evil is causing a response in the human soul, calling forward an even greater good. Now, as you know, my most favorite poet is Friedrich Schiller, according to whom I have named the Schiller Institute. And the reason why he is the most important poet in my mind in Germany is because he had an image of man, that every man has the potential to become a beautiful soul. And his idea of a beautiful soul was that this is a person for whom freedom and necessity, duty and passion are one and the same thing. Now, if you do what is necessary freely, and if you do your duty with passion, there is no contradiction. You don't have a conflict between your emotions and what your reason tells you to do. And basically, Schiller said, you can educate your emotions so that you can blindly follow them, because your emotions will never tell you something different than what reason demands. And Schiller was also very clear that the only person for whom such a condition exists is the genius, because only a person who cherishes his own creativity as the most important aspect of his identity is such a free person. So therefore, what we have to do is to build an alliance, a resistance, a global resistance against the danger of fascism, an alliance of nation builders who love their nation so that they develop, you know, the programs which make possible the livelihood of the present generation and generations to come. And obviously, this is only possible if we liberate enough individuals in each country to know what is their own creativity. Now, Lynn has written many times about that the key to the creativity is the power of imagination. And that comes from studying classical culture, classical poetry, drama, classical music. But if you do that, you will generate the force inside you where you can have a vision of how the world must become if it's going to survive. Now, I think that the absolute key to that is universal education, where every child has access to what is called in the American Declaration of Independence the right to the pursuit of happiness. If you understand with happiness the right for a fulfilled life, to become a truly creative scientist, a truly creative artist. And we have to fight for a situation where the true identity of mankind is going to be with the successive stages of discoveries and perfection of knowledge of the laws of universe. That requires individuals who are totally inner-directed, who are able to reject the zeitgeist, the spirit of the time, and who cultivate in themselves a passion for truth, a passion for science, for beauty, for artistic composition. And I think if we do that in all countries simultaneously, I'm absolutely certain that the moment will come where we look back at the present time as if it would have been infected with a deadly infection. The infection being greed, misanthropy, self-love, egoism, chase after money. And if then, after the worldwide resistance movement was successful, people will look back that that deadly infection was not so deadly, that a medicine was found, and that all of these things will be regarded as childhood diseases like measles, chickenpox, or mumps. And that once you develop the vaccines, you can get over it. And oligarchism, greed, monetarism, and so forth, all of that will be regarded as the childhood diseases of mankind, which no longer will affect us. Now, I think if it will go in the direction of a complete breakdown of civilization and complete chaos, or if we can, in the short term, go for the reconstruction program of Navapa, Plino, Bering Strait, Eurasian Land Bridge, Transaqua, and similar development programs for Africa. If it will go in that way or that way, is the test of the moral ability of mankind to survive. And I'm completely optimistic that it can be done. And, you know, I quote often the beginning part of Schiller's historical writings about the fall of the Netherlands from the Habsburg Empire, where in the beginning he says, I'm telling you this story, this history only so that the reader can have a happy feeling about himself and see that even the most terrible power of the tyrant can be overcome if people have a plan and unite to fight for it. Now, we do have that plan, so let's unite and fight. Let's build an international movement of development that will decide this fight for humanity. Let's evoke in us the power of imagination of how mankind can be when we realize all of us, each of us, our full potential. And let's take the example of all the great thinkers, poets, scientists, and composers before us to be inspired by their creativity, assimilate their thinking and creativity, and carry on the torch to the generations who follow us. Thank you.
We, because of our time delays, we technical matters, we do have a little bit of time for questions and answers. So there are people with a wireless microphone in the auditorium, so that those who would like to ask a question can do so. If anyone would like to ask a question, please raise your hand so we can see you and bring you the microphone. Yes. Please tell us your name and if you're from an institution or who you are. Very good presentation, brilliant presentation. So we have to do things the right way. So the challenge is to make this a reality. In Mexico, there's brilliant thinking. We have the problem, we have good ideas in our constitution, but there are people who didn't actually carry it out. So my question is how to actually carry these great ideas out.
Well, I think that
the only
immediate precedent I can imagine or I can reference is what happened in Germany, in East Germany in 1989. Because for a very long time, people lived in the DDR and most people, you know, were in a kind of inner immigration, except naturally those who believed in the system, but a lot of people were in inner immigration. They didn't like the fact that they couldn't travel. They didn't like the fact travel abroad. They didn't like the fact that they couldn't access international media and many other things. And I don't need to list all the things which were people not happy with. And then, you know, when the system was bankrupt, and that became obvious in the summer of 89, then you had this thing that people would occupy the embassies in Warsaw, in Prague, in Budapest. And then eventually the Monday demonstrations started. And then from September to October, this was swelling very, very quickly. And then, you know, on the 8th of October, you had the 40-year anniversary of the DDR. You still had a gigantic military parade. Honecker said socialism will last for 1,000 years. And then 12 days later, Honecker was out. And 3 weeks later, the Berlin Wall came down. Now, I think that example, when you have the collapse of a system, then, you know, there's naturally the danger that it goes into chaos. But if people have the idea that they will not allow the chaos, that they will basically go into a peaceful resistance and have a discussion and a building of a movement around the reconstruction, not only of their own nation, but, you know, of the planet, I think that we can intervene in this coming crisis where more and more people will recognize that the system of globalization is finished. I just wrote shortly ago an article with the title that the system of globalization and the free market is today more bankrupt than the DDR was in November 89. And that is exactly what it is. Now, the problem was that in 89, the great historical chance was missed. And I think that we have to learn the lesson from that, that this chance of another system going bankrupt must not be missed, but that we absolutely have to put on the agenda the plan for global reconstruction, fight for NAVAPA, Plino, and all the other projects I named. And if we do that simultaneously, I think that the fact that the enemy of civilization wants to eliminate 5 billion people should give us room, you know, to mobilize these 5 billion and more, and basically say that if some people are convinced that the world population should be reduced to 2 billion, then they should please take the lead, you know, and be the leaders of this reduction of population by eliminating themselves first. But I think that we have to mobilize the silent majority, that we have to show people that there is an alternative. And then I think it can be done because, you know, right now, I think the people of Africa, the people of the Arab world and many other places, they already know that they have to take the fight for development into their own hands. So I think that the key thing will be to increase the factions inside every country who know about this alternative, and, you know, just increase in numbers, mobilize, intervene in institutions, show people that this alternative exists, and then I think we have a chance.
Good, we have, is there any other questions? Yes, there's one more question here. Please go ahead. My name is Arturo Martinez Chavez. My question is with regard to what Mrs. Helga Seplerus just said, that it's necessary for people to mobilize through peaceful civil resistance. But in the concrete case of Mexico, it's important to ask, or to ask ourselves, how can you carry out peaceful demonstrations in a country where the President of the Republic, Felipe Calderón, orders that people be shot at? That's what happened in the city of Ciudad Juarez a few days ago, and where the PRD governments here in the Mexico City also dissolve, break up the peaceful demonstrations of the Zapatista resistance. So how in hell can we mobilize people in the middle of a climate of repression? Mobilizations which are not repressed are those of Manuel López Obrador, because they are protected by the security forces of the government, which is from the same party that he comes from. So that's a question I have. How can citizens mobilize in a country which is hyper-penetrated by military intelligence, which is in every university across the country? So that's my question.
Well, I think that unfortunately we have come to the point where we face fascism, and I can only say that, you know, the danger that we will have military dictatorships, not only, you know, in one country but, you know, a whole bunch of countries, that is a very real problem right now. It's being discussed in many countries. As a matter of fact, you know, we have an open discussion about that in the United States. We have concerns expressed in Europe about that. And there I can only say the reason why I invoked De Gaulle and the resistance against Nazism, the resistance in France. I could have mentioned the you know, resistance in Germany, the White Rose. Maybe we soon will be in a situation where we have to use these modes of resistance. And I think that, you know, the key question is, you know, to be, you know, adequate to the situation, organize meetings which are not, you know, subject to such attacks, because they are discussing reconstruction, but also keep in mind that we are in a resistance mode, and that, you know, in a certain sense requires courage, it requires intelligence, it requires studying historical examples, you know, what did people do under similar conditions? Just because the world is in danger to go to hell, we cannot stop fighting. You know, so if it's risky, well, then we have to find the courage to do it and find the intelligence not to take unnecessary risks. But I think we have to fight. There is no other way.
Thank you very much. Our time has run out for questions and answers. We are going to continue this discussion later. What I can tell you that if you have any other questions, any other matters, some of our organizers, our members here, will be available to continue the discussion that began here. And I don't know if there's anything more which Helga would like to say in closing, any brief remarks before we proceed with the remainder of our program.
No, I think I just want to say that, you know, if you look at the long-term evolution of the universe and the long-term evolution of mankind, I think that there is absolute hope. I think that mankind is not yet at the end of its development. It's just at the very first baby steps. And I think that if you think about the laws of the universe and place your identity in that lawfulness, you are sort of, you know, you have the inner strength to fight this battle, because you realize that there is a higher power with us, and that the enemy is operating on false laws, which are in complete clash and contradiction to the reality of the physical universe around us. So, you know, I think that we have to just have this inner strength to wage this fight. And I have come to the conclusion that the best way to overcome fear is by love for mankind. And that has to be expressed, you know, in a very concrete fashion. And when you're not afraid, you are free. So I think that that is my message.